This podcast is brought to you by Amusement Warehouse Magazine, the industry's largest trade publication. We cover amusement parks, carnivals, fairs, festivals, history, safety columns. We really got it all when it comes to the amusement business. Only remaining print publication in the amusement industry on a regular basis. So if you're interested in what the amusement industry has to offer, subscribe today. You can subscribe by logging on to amusementwarehouse.com, carnivalwarehouse.com, or amusementparkwarehouse.com. Guest today is Mike Featherston with Gold Star Amusements and Gold Star Manufacturing. Mike, welcome. Thanks for coming on with us.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So you're at the fair in Spencer, Iowa right now.
That's a pretty big one. The greater Clay County Fair.
And that's where Jeremy came from. He was at the Iowa State Fair now, isn't it? Is that the fair?
That he did. Yep. He was in Missouri prior to this and then here at Clay County and then he moved down up to Des Moines to the Iowa State Fair. You're correct.
You say, I knew you when you were a little kid, when you were a little fair matcher.
Back in the day. The other part about this is Jerome Hertel.
Hertel, right? He
was the manager at the South Dakota State Fair. And then he took his dream job of going to the Alaska State Fair. And then now his grandkids are getting bigger and he wants to be close to them. So he came back here. And so now Jerome Hertel is the manager of the Clay County Fair.
Is that right? I didn't see who the appointed manager. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask that actually, who's running it. That's great.
So that really worked out kind of nice, you know.
That's great. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about your family, as I was reading a little bit on your website in different places, has a long, long history in the business from the 1940s, right? Started with the last name was Flink or F-L-I-N-K.
The Flinks. Uh-huh.
The Flinks. And so now you've branched out a bit and you're in the manufacturing business, building some rides and doing some things. How did that all come about? There's so many, Jared Davis, I interviewed the other day with Wisdom and European manufacturers. There's so many manufacturers that start out as carnivals and then kind of branched out into the manufacturing business. That's always interests me to see how that came about.
Yeah. Well, just go back to the Flinks. That was Jack Thompson's grandmother. And then his mother was a Flink. And then, of course, we'll just keep moving so I don't tie you up for 80 years. But I was hoping
you had a chart that you had behind you with the genealogy that you point to.
So Jack went out and bought a Tilt-A-Whirl and Bill Stanley, William D. Stanley shows, they were cousins and they went out on their own each with their own ride. And then two of them split, created Jack Thompson shows and then William D. Stanley shows. So Jack Thompson is my father-in-law and he passed away at age of 51 years old.
Oh, no.
And I was 29 at the time. So then that's when Connie and I took over the Jack Thompson shows. And then in 92, we created Gold Star Amusements. So we've been out here for 32 years, I believe it is, with Gold Star. And then we heard that Sellner Manufacturing was being sold to Larson International. And I'm only... well, was only 50 miles away from there. So I called Jeff Novotny to see about just purchasing equipment because I knew he didn't need 20 welders, you know, because he had a shop of his own up and running. And I went down there to meet with him just to buy equipment from Sellner Manufacturing. And one thing led to the other. They had a representative there from the bank, and he kept telling me how this would be a great proposition for me. And I kept telling him that, no way. I had no aspirations to get into the manufacturing business. So then the more I looked at it, we ended up purchasing the property. And the buildings, and the business went to Texas with Larson. And one thing to the other, as soon as we made the purchase, come to find out there's fabricators, welders, fiberglass guys that live in that town that were unemployed. So we started, and I had, when I bought the facility, it was strictly an investment. And it just evolved so quickly that, you know, we started hiring guys from the area, and we were going to just build our own rides or rebuild. And then, my wife one day, and Richard Hansen, God bless him, they got to thinking and talking and saying that, well, Sellner's, all they had to do was create another vehicle on the spin rides and they'd still be in business. So Richard and my wife got on the internet and started playing or looking on sites for kids' toys. And they decided that the puppy was the most popular kids' toy. And one thing to the other, got together with a guy and a developer, and they developed the puppy. So, and then we called it the puppy roll. And it's been about 8 years we've been manufacturing them. And I think we're up to 32 or 33 rides that we've outfitted with puppies on them. So it's just one thing to the other.
So is the puppy the only thing that you, make, or is there other vehicles or characters or anything, or is it just the puppy?
No, the puppy is the only one we do. And we, for a long time, we are contracted with Larson to manufacture all the fiberglass for the Sellner amusement line, the elephants, the bears. And so we would for the last 10 years or 14 years, actually, we have been remaking things like that for Larson.
So so Larson bought basically what was Sellner, Tilt-A-Whirl, and
correct,
including the spin rides. Okay, I gotcha. And so you just did a sort of an offshoot on the rides, the puppy roll, which is a popular vehicle and character.
Yeah, we all we've been doing is, you know, they had 13, Sellner had created 13 different vehicles prior to us creating the puppy. So the puppy's actually the 14th vehicle. And that's what they did for, I want to say, 20 some years there. They just kept reinventing the wheel, and people liked to have a new characters, and it was an affordable alternative. And that's what we've done with our puppies. They send us their old merry-go-round or barrels or whatever, and then we completely disable it, dismantle it, disable, same thing. And then we blast, paint, powder coat, and put puppies on them, and out the door they go.
And you found those do really well. It's a rebirth of the ride, basically. You can.
And that's what it is, you know. People that had berries, they wanted a Dizzy Dragon. And then when they got the Dizzy Dragon, then they wanted something else 8 years later. And they're affordable. We can do a puppy for approximately, different situations, how much work in the trailer and things. But on average, you know, $150,000 to $160,000. And that's with the new vehicles and us going through everything and making sure every brake is right, every bearing, race, seal is new, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So in today's market, $150,000, that's pretty reasonable.
Yeah, today's market, if we would have had this conversation 10 years ago, you'd be like, what, $150,000?
Correct.
It's mm-hmm. incredible how much prices have gone up. And I don't buy rides much, at least anymore. But I was looking at like a scrambler or something, you know, that I knew the price of back in the day, and they told me the prices today, and it's shocking. It really is shocking how much they go.
Yeah, it is. Labor's up, materials up. Everybody wants more for everything they have. It's kind of, I don't know where the top is gonna, or where it's gonna end at.
Right.
How far can this go?
You sound like me. I do the same thing with pricing. Like, you know, I'm working with a carnival or a fair, and you're talking about what the wristband is or what the, even the gate price at some of these fairs. And I'm just wondering when, you know, in business school, you call it elasticity of demand. It's like how, you know, when you raise a price, how much less will you get, you know? And for a little while, it's been, you raise a price and it didn't really affect anything, but eventually it does, you know? So it's when that's going to happen and how we deal with it is going to be a big decision-making process.
And, you know, in all the independent food items, you know, out here on the independent Midway, it just wasn't long ago, the average price of an item was $5 or $6.
Right.
And now it's $10 and $12. And we're seeing, I'm seeing, I guess, but these people selling lemonades, they sell a $5, 16 ounce, a $10, 20 ounce, and say 20 or 15 or 20, anyways, what I'm getting to is a 64 ounce lemonade they'll make, and it'll be $20. And the family of five will buy one of those and just pass it around the family. And we're seeing more and more of that happening. I am. Other people maybe don't want to admit it, but we are getting in their back pocket. And where is the cutoff, and how much can we charge? And yeah, it's I don't know where the limit is, but
well, you see it through promotions and discount days, like when the people are you know, did a couple of fairs this year, marketing wise or running wise. And, you know, the discount days did really, really well, which is another indication that people are being a little right. more cost conscious, or maybe the prices are just too high. You know, I know people push back that prices went up, and it's true, but I think there was also a little bit of taking advantage because you could get it, you know, so you did do it. But at some point yeah. it's got to even out a little bit because people can't mm-hmm. afford to pay top dollar for everything. And fairs are, and carnivals and events are, I think, a volume business. You know, you want people to come multiple times. You don't want it to be like, I saved all year to go one day to the fair. That's not a good business plan, you know?
No, it's not. And we struggle all the time. We'll sell a passport to fun, a week-long pass at the fair, whether it's 5 days or 9 days, and say average $60. And if it's a 9-day fair, then divide that by 60 is $5 a day. No, it's what it's
a little less than seven. Yeah.
Six, nine. Yeah. Right. In
almost seven.
Anyways, and it's very, very cheap. And you think, man, you should get at least, you know, a 9-day fair, we should get at least $10 a day. But, you know, if you go there, you know, then you eliminate people, you know, that can afford it and come to your, eliminate people coming to your fair. And then therefore your drink sales are down, your game revenue is down, and it's a tough situation, but where is it going to top out at? In November here, everything will be fine.
I'll be fixed.
Just be starting all over. That's all it's going to do.
When you got into the manufacturing business, what were some of the things that kind of surprised you a little bit about it, like that you didn't plan for when you got in? Were there a few things that you're like, oh, okay, I understand now?
The whole thing. one advantage I did have, I hired a couple guys from Sellner Manufacturing.
Right.
And they had good work ethics, and they knew what quality is. And what was okay for us in the carnival business out in the dirt in the backyard, you know, spray painting a carnival ride, was not going to fly anymore. And, you know, they want their paint booth. They want it clean, immaculate. Things that surprised me, I don't know, that was probably the biggest change, just us getting used to working indoors. And when it go to rain, you know, we didn't have to stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Got a roof over our head. I would say we're still learning. And surprising things, mostly the employees, but like in any business, they surprise us a lot.
But, and the hours are probably a lot different than, you know, the they work a 9 to 5 and they go home at whatever time. And I don't know if you work weekends.
Yeah, 7 to 4:30 Yeah, is what they like. And
no weekends or weekends.
We might work a half a day on Saturday. What we like to do on Saturdays is change all the air filters in the paint booth or scrub the floors or change the water in the, you know, maintenance in the shop. Take 4 or 5 hours and get caught back up, put all the tools away, clean everything up, oil it, change, you know, service the air compressor and things like that. That's usually what we try to do on Saturdays. And if we work, so. Anyways,
so the manufacturing side showed you a little bit about, you know, like you said, the paint shop and different things. But what about going the other way? Like, what did you bring from your knowledge of actually operating the rides, bring them up, put them down to the, did you make any changes based upon your experience, you know, moving the rides and actually operating them?
In the manufacturing business?
Yeah, like Zamperla was telling me they you know, when they started operating a park, you know, they learned a lot about, like, they operate the ride and then they look at the traffic pattern, they see how things work and they make some modifications based upon their experience, which I think is a great synergy. So did you learn anything from, did you bring anything from the carnival side of your business to the manufacturing side?
Well, one thing that I brought was able to branch out and have these guys working and rebuilding more than just selling their equipment. That was probably the biggest thing. We've done, you know, teaching them the ferro theories, and there's so many little things that I was able to, I don't know if, I don't have any right off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But little things that I would tell them that were okay to do or that they could do that they didn't know. Trying to think here. As far as the painting went, they taught me because, you know, we would buy a paint gun and throw it in the garbage when we're done painting. That was what I did for 15 years prior, just, you know, because by the time you go to get it again, it's either gummed up or so. Every time we do a paint job, we just figure in the cost out in the carnival, you know. But there, no, they want the $1,000 spray gun or $500, whatever they are. And we keep
it. You don't seem to be throwing those out.
Yeah, there's, I don't know if there's, maybe one thing that I did teach them was that they didn't have to have all DuPont products in every batch of paint, that we could use an outside activator or, you know, there is ways and the primers. One of the biggest things too is everybody, every product line you get with, they want you to use all of their primer. They want their primer, their sealer, their reducers, their hardeners, you know, right on down the line. And some of the guys didn't know that you could put DuPont over a lesser money primer.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that'd be probably the biggest thing in the paint department that they didn't know.
What about the, like selling those things? Are you, do you sell them all yourself or do you have somebody out there, trying to make deals and sell for you?
Well, what's happened here, the crazy thing is they've been selling themselves for the last 4 years. Prior to COVID, you know, we were at all the trade shows displaying. And but since COVID, we haven't been displaying and we haven't been advertising in Showtime magazine. And I had my biggest order last fall. I had 6 puppies, just one call and right after the other. And I attribute that to them seeing them on other people's midways. And when you guys go out and do maybe an interview, if you do one live and there's a puppy in the background, my clientele, which is a carnival business, sees them and they want one. And then they call and find out how affordable they really are.
Well, that's a big factor, affordability, and the others that you're able to deliver them too, because right now there's, it's really tough to buy anything and get it within a year or even 2 or 3 sometimes, you know.
Yep. The first 5, we did a real good job of getting them out on time. And then this last one, the 6th one, it just got delivered Sunday. And it was supposed to have been delivered, I'm not afraid to say it, June 1st. I guaranteed the guy. And oops, I'm a little late. But this one, you know, the first five, like I said, went like clockwork. But this last
today's world, June 1st for August is early.
That's yeah, compared to what some of these other manufacturers are doing. Yeah.
Yeah, they just did.
I pride myself in making all those deadlines, and we blew this one. But we had gearbox problems. We couldn't get the gearbox, and then you got to get the gearbox fitted before you can powder coat. And then we need it was just a supply chain issue on this
right. last one. And it just goes on down the line.
Yeah, I call the electrician. He says he's coming in on Monday to wire. And he calls you on Monday and says, oh, I'm going on vacation this week. whoa, you know, and stuff like that. It's just, one thing after the other. I told the last guy that I delivered this ride to, I'm not going to tell you when it's going to get there anymore. I told him in July. I can't make up any more excuses.
Yeah, you're hoping for the best, but it doesn't always happen. Well, yeah. I guess.
But he got it. I talked to him about an hour ago, and he was setting it up. And he said, it still smells like fresh paint. Would you paint it on Friday? And I said, yeah, a little bit we did. Touched up. So he got her. Looks good. Built him a brand new trailer to go with it. And I went and put a couple $1,000 worth of wheels and tires on it, aluminum wheels, to make him feel a little better. And yeah.
So, are you refurbing all kinds of different rides, or do you try to stick to a certain type of ride, or what will you
here,
do?
Here lately, no. Well, the spin rides, any of them spin rides, we do a lot of them. They sent mm-hmm. them to us to change their main bearings or fix their electric brakes, put bearings, races, and seals in the vehicles. Yeah, Sousa, we do probably, for every puppy, we probably do 5 spin rides, repairs, updates, sure. or repaints. We pretty much do anything there. But the here lately, the past 6 months, I've wanted to... past year, I've had to stop taking in outside work because the carnival equipment got behind. And so this past July, we got one zipper out of the shop. We have another zipper in the shop, totally in pieces right now, ready to go to sandblast and paint or come back for paint. But but we got to get our Pharaoh's Fury through the shop, and we want to get our Ring of Fire through the shop. So I've been pushing off outside work. There is no one ride that, you know, if I don't know anything about the ride, then I probably will not want to try to rebuild it. But we've done probably 3 Century Wheels, 3 or 4, oh, wow. 3 or 4 Pharaoh's Furies. I can't think. A couple Tornadoes. We've done all kinds of stuff. Plus our own arsenal of rides. You know,
do you see a little bit more of that because of the refurbishment side? Because it is so hard to buy a new ride, and they're so expensive, and the lead times are so long. So a lot of people elect, I guess, to redo the ride rather than try and get something new.
Yeah, and I kind of feel bad. I've got a couple of friends, you know, that have been friends in the business, have asked me to rebuild, to take on a couple jobs. And I had to tell them, you're going to have to give me a call in another year. And, you know, and they said, well, another year, that'll be such and such date. I said, yeah. They said, pencil me in. I said, what ride do you want to bring? And this is a compliment, you know. And I'm old enough now, I probably should toot my own horn. But they said, we don't know yet, but just pencil us in. We want you to rebuild one.
That's great. So, that's a great testament to your abilities to fix things, and their trust in you.
We care. You know, and if it isn't, I don't know, there's no shoddy work. How's that? You know, and if you do, you won't get another job. So.
Yeah. No, and with your personal pride and ethic, too, and you want it to be right, whether or not the new business is coming or not, it's important to you that it comes out right and looks right and is right.
And the beauty of it, we've been in there now 14 years.
Has it really? Holy mackerel.
some of the, that's what I said when I discovered that. So, wow, I'm getting old. Anyways, we built around us support staff for rebuilding carnival rides who, you know, when we call, they answer the phone. They want, you know, we've become pretty good vendors. They became pretty good vendors for us, and they kind of like our revenue. But we've got an electric motor guy that's within a mile of the factory that's out of this world. And doesn't matter if they're the Roulin motors, the, I'm trying to think what it is on the Century wheels and things. Those are Sin, I'm not thinking the name of it. But it doesn't matter what motors we bring to him. Even off of the rides from the Czech Republic, they take them on and we get them back and we never have to take them back to them. Then we got a hydraulic guy that's just amazing up in this Savage, Minnesota. And we just, anything we take him comes back proper, you know, one time. And we got our sandblast guy, our powder coat guy. And we got all these vendors around us that just make, well, we've established a wonderful working relationship with them. And it makes our job easier and makes us look pretty smart.
Yeah, it's amazing how those little businesses crop up around a manufacturer or something else. I'm thinking of, I know when I was kind of first in the industry at the beginning, like there's so many food manufacturers in Ohio, small ones and yeah, Otterbachers and different ones. I was always curious, you know, why they sort of cropped up all around a certain area. You know, it's weird how they, I mean, obviously, you know, stuff in Gibbtown's there because everybody winters there, but you know, some of the other places around the country, it's funny, you get these little pockets of carnival related businesses or park related businesses that are in certain areas, and you know, who knows how they got there. I'm sure somebody does, mm-hmm. but it's always curious to me how they crop up.
You know, and it just continues to grow, you know, like I've got a machine shop 8 miles away. I got a couple of them actually, but I got one that there's a guy rebuilding rides in Florida that I'm friends with. And he will, when he needs machining, he'll ship it from Tampa, Florida, all the way to Faribault, wow. Minnesota to have the work done. And they send it back to him. But wow. These guys are that good. They're so, Sellner had so much talent around them.
They did. They did.
Yeah. And, but yeah, so I know for fact there's been two incidences, and people will draw me on a napkin what they want machined, and I can send it over to them, and they understand, you know, so it's really kind of nice.
Yeah, it's nice when they know the business or they're familiar with, you don't have to explain so mm-hmm. much, you know, because there's probably a lot of people that could do it, but it would take a lot of explaining to get them to really understand what
correct.
To do.
Yeah. They and those guys are pretty sharp guys. Even like the machinists there, they used to run a big drag racing operation out of their shop. And now everybody else that drag races and blows, say, transmissions apart, they send them to them to weld them back together. So anyways, yeah, it's just one hand feeds the other and it continues. And the other nice thing about it is when they're nice people, you know, sure. It just makes doing business with people so much easier.
Absolutely.
Where was your beginning in the business?
I used to work. I was in graduate school, get my MBA, and I was working for the Leukemia Society, running special events. And I was real frustrated with the events they were doing because, you know, I always had to bug somebody to make money, like had to get them to sign up to be a celebrity waiter. And then they had to sell 10 tickets. And I said, there's gotta be a better way of raising money. And across the street from my office was the Hampton Coliseum, a big Coliseum there. And Amusements of America was set up there. And I remember when I grew up in New Jersey that my church used to make money somehow from a carnival. I remember they used to, I don't know why I remember these things, but they used to like read the budget and like bingo was like a way up there. And then the annual carnival was a big fundraiser. So I, you know, I walked across the street and I saw Dominic and John and I was like, you know, I know my church used to make some money from a carnival somehow. And, you know, we do fundraising for Leukemia Society. is there a way, you know, how would I raise money for Leukemia Society? They said, well, find us a spot, you know, a location somewhere. So I named this mall. And I said, well, what about this mall? And they said, oh, you can't get it. I said, why not? And they're like, well, we've tried before. You can't play there. You can't do it. Well, the marketing director was on my board of directors. So I walked back across the street and I called her up. Her name was Susie Waters. I don't know if I remember that. I go, hey, Susie, can we have a carnival over at the mall to raise some money for the Leukemia Society? She said, sure, no problem. Just, you know, let me know when. And I said, okay. So I went back across the street. I saw John, and he told me I was full of S.
Because
I got the thing. I said, call her right here. So we called her, and she's like, yeah, we can do that. And so that's kind of how I got started. I learned more about the business, and I learned more about fairs. And that really, you know, the whole thing interested me. Sure. So I started doing a lot of marketing and learning about things. And I'm always curious. So I just, you know, kind of did more and more over the years.
So how much did you raise, do you mind me asking, the first time for the Leukemia Foundation when you played the mall?
You know, I got them several spots. So I think I had a budget that year of like $100,000. And I think I raised at least half with a few, you know, events of my whole budget from that. And, you know, they were on my butt because I did some after work parties with music and beer and things. And I did a couple different things, and the national would always call me up. The lady, she's like, why can't you just stick to the events that we do? And I said, well, they're boring.
They're not making no money.
These things better. But I was successful, so they couldn't say too much. But I was always trying to think outside the box to do stuff that was different.
And, you know, the beauty of it is we are 90% of our locations we go to. We are their biggest, one of the biggest or largest incomes on their budget sheets.
On the carnival side. Yeah, absolutely. You don't really, I mean, there's not many businesses, you know, and with my business background, when you think about it, there's not many businesses that, you know, it's, I know it's not a donation, it's a, you know, some sort of joint venture, but that gives such a big percentage of their income to a nonprofit. And, you know, when you go and play at the firehouse and the fire department makes, you know, nowadays is, might be $40,000-$50,000 from an event or something like that that they make.
Correct.
And then next year they have a new truck, and you knew you played a part in doing that truck and bringing that truck to them.
Yeah.
That's a pretty special thing. You know, it is, you know, no matter how cynical, you know, you might think some of the carnival owners are, they get a lot of joy out of doing that and you know, providing those communities with opportunities and doing good in that community in a lot of ways.
And that's why, like, the fairs now, it's taken a few years, but they're getting behind the initiative with the OABA for the CARES Act. Carnivals are real entertainment. And we've got, the last I had heard, 67 in the House that have signed on to the bill. And so we're looking for more state senators or representatives to sign on this CARES, so that we know next year we will be able to have our employees. Right now we're having to file multiple visas, jump through hoops, and you've heard
interlotteries.
I'm beating a drum here, but this CARES, Carnivals Are Real Entertainment, is very, we need more of the agricultural fairs getting behind us. And and my daughter asked me a week or two ago, we're at a fair, and Scott Kozelka, he's a Zone 4 director with the IAFE, and he was the manager of that fair. And he brought in a state representative for us to meet and talk about the CARES Act in his office. And when we left there, my daughter said, why aren't more fairs like Scott, you know, where they want to get behind and promote? And the bottom line is, it's time. And not all fairs have a full-time, you know, fair manager year-round. Most of them are part-time or volunteers, or they get $2,500 a year for doing the job. And that's the only problem. But we are now getting some of the fairs that have full-time staffs and things getting behind and helping and talking to the local representatives. And that's helped a lot. But, you know, and that's why it's difficult for us to reach out to some of the smaller county fairs. We could, if we could just get all their voices, get them calling their state representatives it would be a slam dunk, but they're volunteers, and how much volunteering can they do, you know?
It's funny. I was just talking with Marla Calico from the IFE and having a little bit of a nonprofit background, there's nothing that sort of annoys me more than people saying I'm only a volunteer. I at the IFE, I think it was zone one or zone two, one time they asked me to talk and do a talk. They said, what would you want to do? I said, I want to do, if I volunteer at the soup kitchen, I still have to serve soup. You know, don't volunteer if you're not going to do anything. If you're going to make an excuse why you can't do something, don't volunteer. Find somebody that can do the job, because you hear it all the time. I'm just a volunteer. I'm just a volunteer. I'm just a volunteer. Don't volunteer if you're not going to do the work. If you're volunteering, do the work that you need to get done. And those boards, they have a lot of people that they know or they work with, or, you know, the board of a fair. I'll guarantee any fair, if you poll the board, they probably know their local representative in a way, or at least one person removed from the representative. So there's probably plenty they can do, even as volunteers. That wouldn't take much effort at all to make a phone call, you know, and it's not that big a deal. But if you're going to volunteer, do the work. That doesn't excuse you from not doing any work, you know. And I know it might sound harsher a little bit, but, you know, being in a nonprofit background and you know, having volunteered at things, I can't stand hearing it, because you hear it a lot, you know, in certain sectors, you know. Oh, we can't do that. We're all volunteers. We can't do this because we're all volunteers. Nonsense. Well, you can do it.
We can help them. If you know of any of them, or if any of them hear this podcast, can get behind and make that phone call, that'd be fabulous.
Yeah. Pull your boards and talk to your boards.
We're trying to get
it's going
to
be a separate,
board.
It's going to be a separate new visa class, right?
Correct. I guess I should explain that, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
We're going after a performer's visa, a P5, and it'd be P5. For carnival employees. And circuses use the performer visas, P1s, to bring people in from other countries to perform. And that's where we'd like to go. And we want to get completely away from immigration. You know, every time we talk about H-2B and, you know, we get the topics are, well, the unions don't like it. Whoa, you know, what do you mean? Unions ain't got nothing to do with the amusement business, amusement business. And
they ran away years ago from the amusement business. The unions ran away years ago from the amusement business. They tried to organize in the past, but never worked out too good.
Not a good idea. So bottom line forgot my train of thought. But
you were talking about the visas and the new line of visas that they're entertainers or performers. Yeah.
Right.
And the objections people say for immigration.
Well, the other thing I was going to get at is, do we get capped out since probably 2022? The cap is being reached every year. And then we wait for another 90 days to see if we can get our employees back. Then our employees, if they got to wait 90 more days to come back to work, when we release them in, say, October or November, you know, it makes it hard on them. You know, they got families they want to support too. And people will call us in the spring and want to know if we can send rides here or there or do this extra event. And we can't answer them because we haven't received our employees yet. And we don't, you know, there's no guarantees anymore.
No, so it's difficult. It can be tough. And if there is no, visa program for foreign workers, a lot of shows would be in trouble. I mean, I'm sure they'd figure it out somehow, some way, but it wouldn't be it wouldn't be good. Definitely wouldn't be good.
And, you know, and we probably could do it the other way, but my word, you know, you just don't get any sleep at night when you do it the other way. They're only there a week or two and they're gone, and we're forever training them. And the only reason they came and got a job with us is because they seen the Ferris wheel while they were walking down the street. And, oh yeah, I want a job. And, you want a job, but you know, the employees from afar, they have a purpose, and they come and they want to work and they want to be able to feed their family. And they come here for this job, knowing exactly what this job is. And you know, 10, 15, about 10, 15 years ago, I never wanted to go above 50% foreign labor. But as the years have trekked down here, it's just harder and harder to get American guys and girls that want to travel 9 months out of the year.
Yeah, the travel is really the biggest hurdle in a lot of ways. You know, getting the people to do the work, it's hard, but you could probably do it. But getting them to travel every week, that takes a special class.
And the other thing is, you know, our equipment, the equipment that they're manufacturing today, that's the other thing we try to do, and all the manufacturers try to do, is like the farming industry, make it so we don't need nine guys to set up one ride. You know, one or two guys tops, you know, and if we have a ride that has to have two employees to operate it, you know, that becomes a struggle, you know, if you're barely have enough guys to operate, you know. For instance, the Starships or the Gravitrons, it's got to have one inside, one outside all the time. And I've seen people even say, well, maybe we shouldn't put it up because it takes two employees. I mean, just think about it. You know, we're trying just one more employee is stopping us from. But years ago, we tried to stay at 50%. And I'm going to say right now we're probably at 80%, 85% foreign labor. And like me and many other, just about the entire amusement industry is rolling on foreign labor. Anybody that's running a decent size operation, they're on foreign labor. And once you get there, it's so nice knowing that you have somebody that's going to be there in the morning.
Yeah, that's
and they wake up sober and come to work.
Yeah, that's nothing like a nightmare back in the day when you wake up and half your crew's gone or part of your crew's gone or something else. It's a little scary. It's a little scary.
And you know, that back then is when the bunkhouses, our first bunkhouse we got was, I think in 1990, Harry Murphy had represented a company and sold it to us. And just for pricing sakes, I think I might have paid $25,000 for it. It had all steel uprights and 040 aluminum on the outside. And man, it was the bomb. I remember pulling into one of those carnivals and just everybody drooling over it. Now you won't touch one, a nice one, for $125,000. But that being said, and then when I ordered it, I wanted doubles. I wanted two people in every room. And people would say, well, it's hard to get two people to room together. But my thought was, I kind of wanted the one to check the other. You know, when you got somebody to talk to at night when you're off work, that kind of helps. That's number one. Number two is, I use the analogy, if a guy's building a bomb in his room and he's in the room by himself, nobody's going to know. But if you got two guys in the room, you know, the guy might rat on him, you know, and then we can get him out of there before the bomb is built. And just all kinds of things like that. So that it's kind of like a buddy system, a check system. And I've been a proponent of the doubles in bunks since 1990. And just this year, the son-in-laws and the daughters, Jesse and Timmy, are handling the main operation out here on the carnival. And they purchased a used bunkhouse. Very nice. But then in the back, it has two or four single rooms. And so prior to today, or a month ago, we had never had any single living quarters.
So. That's funny that you have that philosophy. I don't know if you come from or you have a large family, but there's some people I know that have larger families and they swear by keeping you know, the kids together for the same reasons you were saying. You know, they by themselves, they're on the internet, they're doing whatever, but then their brother, their sister's there. You know, they're only so much safer. Trouble they can get into.
Right, it's safer. And the one educates the other, you know, the younger
that's
one.
That's very wise, I think, Mike. That's very wise.
Yeah. It's been a good thing.
That's very wise.
Something else I was going to mention. Oh, yeah. There was 7 girls and 1 boy, by the way.
Oh, really? Oh, for your family.
Was. That, yeah, that's where I.
So, but from. You married into the business, right? You were saying earlier. That's how'd you come to get involved?
Yeah. Well, I.
How'd you get dragged in?
I was real good at selling corn dogs and lemonade shakeups.
So you just worked for the summer or whatever, or for a.
Yeah, I worked for a guy that only you had to be in college, and then he would hire you in Illinois and work the Phil Guyberson with the Pronto Pups. Illinois, he had that franchise. Mm-hmm. And we run around Illinois there in the summer, and then when the Illinois State Fair hit, we would leave and go back to school. And so it worked out good for him. And that's where it started. And I finished my freshman year in college, and I was supposed to went back to my sophomore year in college. And I don't know, I was having too much fun. And a guy came around, Jack Sturgeon, who was a friend of Phil Guyberson's from Decatur, Illinois, and asked him if he had any guys that wanted to go down south and operate a food stand for him on a carnival. And so Phil, my current boss, had me meet Jack at the Illinois State Fair, or before it. And I said, yeah, I'd love to go down there. And I tell the story when I told my mom and dad that I wasn't coming home to go to school for my sophomore year, that I was going to be going on a carnival. And that went over real big.
Great.
My dad and my mom were there in 48 hours. They drove down to Springfield and, trying to coax me to come back home, you know. And I had pretty well made up my mind. And see, I was playing baseball from the time I was 7 years old till I was, 18, 19 years old, freshman in college even. And that's where they thought I was going to be on the ball field playing for the Cubs, you know.
You and Phil Vivona, Phil Vivona was a baseball player too at Duke. He played a season or two.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that. Well, that's what I did. I pitched. And my dad brought me an article and showed me. If you just sit on the bench, they're going to pay you $12,000 a year. He was showing me salaries and things, and I didn't go back. I'll tell you, I was burned out with baseball. What had happened, once I got into Legion ball, high school, they played me. I pitched and played first base because I was left-handed. And I was a good bat. I was averaging right at the 400, which is very good.
Yeah.
And so when I wasn't pitching, they
were better and very good.
Yeah, wanted me on first base, and they wanted my bat. Well, once I got out of high school there and started playing Legion ball, then they wanted my arm. That was it. They wouldn't let me play first base. So
then
the games went from 7 innings to 9 innings. And then we play a doubleheader on a Saturday. And when Legion ball, we play a doubleheader on one side of town and then a single game at night on a Saturday. I mean, we just played so much baseball. And every other week, we would go out of town, drive over into Chicago, Indiana,
right.
Southern Illinois. And, this guy wanted us to excel, the manager. And when I was having to sit, my rotation for a starter, sit for 3 games, it just started getting to me. I just wasn't used to sitting, If they use me on a Friday and here's a Saturday, sometimes I'd have to sit for 10, 11 hours, and just, I don't know. I got depressed or something and I didn't want to do it anymore. So
you wanted the action.
Yeah. It was just too hard. I'd always go down the third base line or whatever and just play catch with somebody, and I just couldn't sit there for all them hours. So I think that's what kind of changed my philosophy on baseball. But it's amazing today. I've got grandkids that are playing sports and playing baseball too. And to see some things out there that you still remember from, we're talking almost, well, 50 years ago, maybe, that are still relevant today, that you can give them a tip.
Absolutely.
You know, and help them. And it's, I guess it's a gray hair thing. So.
So you were working, you went south with that food stand, and how did you wind up on with Gold Star? How'd you
wind up doing what you're doing? Yeah, it was another crazy story. Is I went with Wayne, who was a neighbor of mine that had already been working for Phil, and they booked the food stands. He had one and I had one on Jack Thompson shows. And so we showed up in Texarkana, Texas at that time. They're on the Texas side. Now they're on the Arkansas side.
In right.
Texarkana. But
is it the opposite?
Yeah, they moved over into Arkansas.
Now. I thought they moved from Arkansas to Texas. Texas to Arkansas, you're saying.
Yeah,
okay.
Texas to Arkansas, yeah. I don't know why. But anyway, so that's where I got off the bus at. And rewind a little more. Wayne, who is running the one food stand and I was running the other, was from my neighborhood. And that's how I got my job with Phil. I got to rewind a little more. Lorne, Wayne's older brother, ran away from home and went out and worked for Phil in Illinois in the Pronto Pup stands. And then he came back and told us about all the stories. He was 2 years older than us, about all the wonderful things that happened. And we said, Lorne, you got to get us a job. Come on, man, get us out of this gas station from pumping gas. And you got to get us a job. So he got Wayne a job. And then 8-9 months later, they got me the job. And so when I went south on Gold Star or Jack Thompson shows, I was working with Wayne, who high school neighborhood friend. And so fast forward, we met Connie Thompson, who is my wife today. Wayne met Karen, who was Connie's friend. Wayne and Karen got married, and then Connie and I got married. And there's five of us, actually, young people on the carnival, and everybody else was older. And that's where we met, down in Texarkana. So it was pretty much full circle when Connie and I went back and booked the fair with Gold Star Amusements at Texarkana about 10 years ago.
You play that now, Texarkana?
Not now. We did for about 5 years there.
Okay.
5-6 years. And then we changed and came here to Spencer. We were jumping 1,000 miles down there, and we're jumping 250 here. So,
That saves a lot of mileage.
Sure. Yeah, a lot of miles. And it's a little cooler up here and right now. And it's, you know, we don't open until late Monday through Thursday and get a 4-day break. And yeah, it's just a little easier. So
that's amazing. Well, how big is, we kind of touched on the show just briefly, but how big of a show do you have now, Carnival, on that side?
You know, I've never wanted to pretend like we're a big show. I've never wanted that, you know, because I always wanted to try and feel like I'm Buzz Barton, the old diamond jewelry guy, always said, you always want to be the big fish in the small pond.
That's true.
So we've got 40 rides.
Wow.
And there's duplicates. This week we can only fit, doggone it. I'm getting my numbers mixed up. I know a few weeks ago we had 38 rides in the air that we could fit. And then in South Dakota, we could only fit 35. So here, I think we're at 32 or 30. I haven't counted this week.
So. And do you mostly operate one unit or two sometimes? Or
we split in twos for about 6 weeks in the summer here. And then in the spring, we do some second spots. When there's 30 rides around, you can only put up, say, 15 at a festival or...
Right.
You know, so we're always trying to book another something to keep income coming.
Second spot. That's neat. See, I mean, so it's been a pretty much a continuous line from Jack Thompson shows and the carnival before that. so you really, you can trace your history back 40 to the 40s, right? I mean, of gold stars.
I believe so. Yeah. We're, I think we're sixth generation, or are we seventh now out here? I think we're sixth, might be seventh. I get it mixed up.
Yeah. But, yeah. There's quite a few. Mm-hmm. I was looking at the history. It was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and I mentioned Timmy and Jesse, and then when we do our splits in the summer, doing two county fairs at a time, Melissa and Adrian, my daughter and son-in-law, they operate that unit. And my son Mike is in a, after COVID, we didn't know if we were going to open in 21, and he opened up in a zoo in Brainerd, Minnesota. He put a little amusement park, 8 rides, in the back of the zoo. And been doing very well with that. And he goes home at 6 o'clock at night.
And that's nice. That's very nice.
And then he's got a couple food stands. He goes out and Brainerd International Raceway's there. He goes out there and does the food at their drag racing events or mud things or whatever they're all doing.
Mud bugs.
Yeah. And then he's also breaking into rebuilding equipment. What he's been since COVID, this is, people will drive these beautiful food stands underneath low underpasses, and they seem to have his number on speed dial to rebuild them back.
So they keep him in business.
He's been doing all kinds of odd stuff, and he says he likes it better. He doesn't have the stress that he had out here on the carnival.
There's no question that moving component is a big factor. What do you see? Is the future bright for the carnival business, or are we going through some difficult times where it may go away, or do you think everything's going to be all right?
I think we'll be fine. Whenever people ask me, you know, we always have hurdles. Right now, the biggest hurdle is the foreign labor. We got to get through this. And as the foreign labor topic rolls around, there's some carnival owners out there saying the sky is falling if we don't we don't get this, you know. And where I've come from is listening to the older guys and deciding whether what they're telling me is BS or if it's a good hint. And I've gotten a lot of good hints from a lot of good people because I got started so young. I got through into the business. And I remember old Roger Hildebrand calling me and telling me, when you walk in that room, Mike, you are equal to them. They don't hold anything above you. And, you know, just after my father-in-law passed away, giving me hints on things. And I'll never forget those hints and things. But where I'm going with this is my father-in-law, Jack Thompson. We were talking about bird flu, swine flu, or I don't know what it was, you know, before he passed away. And he said, well, Mike, he said, let me tell you something. He said, when they made us go to the Minnesota Junction box on the Midway, oh, my God. He said, everybody was saying, we'll never be able to open. We'll never be able to do another fair again. And, you know, things like that. So I've been listening to the swine flu, the bird flu, the Asian flu, the COVID, and how much more can we overcome?
The help, probably, if you remember not that long ago, I remember reading in AB, the casinos were going to kill the industry. That was going to be the end of the industry by having all the casinos open up.
And they did take the edge in some of the rural America. They took the edge off the carnival games. But what's happened now is I feel that these good amusement operators have changed the way they market their game. And it's been very good. It's been very good for them.
But you're right, though. I'm reading a history like of Conklin shows and some things right now. And it's amazing how the problems now were the problems then, too. It's comforting in a way because like they were facing the same things and maybe in a little different way and a little different, facing, but it's essentially the same thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you gotta realize that. And it's so easy. You know, we're so busy out here getting from A to B, getting the rides maintained, getting out from the rainstorm, getting the generator repaired. We need a new, you know, there's so many things that we end up doing that we lose sight of what our real goal is. And we lose sight that, you know, all the happy faces that we do put on
people. That's very true. That's very wise. You're a wise guy.
It's you know, I've always said the hardest person in the carnival to control is myself.
That's very true.
It's you know, now that I got time to look at it, and that's what I do around here is try to give them my wisdom.
You're giving them a lot. I've interested what you said so far. Believe it or not, we've been talking for an hour, so it went by quick.
I was wondering what we were going to talk about today.
Yeah, we've got plenty. I feel like I'm missing 100 questions, but I really appreciate your time, and your insights are fascinating. And hopefully we'll get to talk again, or I'll see you in Gibtown or someplace down the road.
All right. Enjoy and rock on.
Thanks so much, Mike. I appreciate it.
Bye.
This podcast is brought to you by Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Our staff of professionals can guide you through your setup, assist with customer service, even on the weekends when you most need it, and help increase your sales through promotions that work. Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Sign up today at innovativeticketing.com.